everyone. It's Sal Lamo of Rift Magazine, here today with Robert McChesney. Robert McChesney is the author of several books on media and politics, professor of communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, host of the weekly talk show Media Matters on Will Am Radio, and co-founder of the media reform organization Free Press. Robert McChesney, how are you feeling today?
I'm doing fine. I should probably correct update your biography of me. I've retired as of last year as a professor. And I stopped doing the Media Matters interview show 9 years ago, approximately. It's a dated biography.
Well, I appreciate the correction, but also congrats on retiring.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah. So today we're going to talk about media, the internet. That's the general direction. But in listening to your discussions, one of the things that stood out the most to me was you discussed the socialist origins of the internet, and I had never, that's like pretty foreign to me. So can you briefly discuss the history of the internet and like the trajectory from its socialist origins to like its hyper-capitalist applications today?
Yeah, it'll be a long story. I'll condense as much as possible. But the important thing to remember for most people today, I think someone immersed in the internet and digital communication assumes that it was something that free market genius created, that only in America could these brilliant minds and entrepreneurs and this pursuit of profit and magical technologies come together in a cocktail to create this revolution, and that they go hand in hand. When in fact, I think the evidence is pretty clear that the internet only exists today because of massive government investments to keep it going, driven first and foremost by the Pentagon, who saw it as something valuable for their military purposes, and that only the private sector only really became interested in it decades after it was first launched. Initially in the 1960s and 70s, the only private sector interest was getting contracts to help the government with this thing, the ARPANET and later the internet work. But it was done almost exclusively with military spending, and all the heavy lifting on the way it would develop the protocols was done at a handful of research universities, public, oftentimes public, not always, University of Illinois, where I taught, Michigan, MIT, Caltech, Berkeley, a handful of schools basically were doing all the heavy lifting on the protocols, bankrolled to no small extent by the Pentagon, the federal government. And famously, in the early 1970s, the government approached AT&T, the phone monopoly, and said, you know, this thing's costing a lot of money. How do you like to take it over and run it for us? And AT&T turned them down, said, no, we can't make any money on that thing. You do it. There's no future there, at least that they could see. Or if there was a future, it might challenge AT&T's monopoly, and they didn't want to mess with it. So at any rate, that was the history of the internet. And so when people say, well, why did the United States develop the internet? It was really because of aggressive public spending, public sector spending that stayed with it when no private sector interested group would have any interest in pursuing it. Now, in the 1990s, really starting at the beginning of the decade, after really 20 years of relatively slow growth, by the early 1990s, it exploded first on college campuses and then across the country in short order, became ubiquitous by the middle of the decade, really, and certainly by the end of the decade. And at that point, commercial interests became very interested in it. But even in the 1990s, and during the internet boom and the emergence of the World Wide Web, except for being an internet service provider, there was no sense of how you made money on this thing. You know, one of the great lines from the middle of the 1990s was people active in the internet said, it's unclear who's supposed to pay who. I mean, do I pay you or do you pay me? And how you made money, what they used to call the killer application, was pretty much unclear. And that didn't become clear until broadband became the order of the day by the beginning of this century, by the beginning of the 2000 decade. And then suddenly it became clear that there was money to be made. But now this is deep into the history and development of the internet that this becomes the case.
It's kind of interesting to think that AT&T would turn down something like that.
Well, there's also related to that, in 1980 or 81, I think it was, there was a movement afoot. Email had already started and was being used in government circles, in a handful of circles, but not in the general population. And there was a movement basically to have the post office take over emails, because they saw that eventually as something that would replace a lot of postal mail. So the post office would be the natural public agency to conduct it, because they have a history of managing communication without censorship. They could safely handle it. And it looked like it would have to be a monopoly, and the post office is set up to be a monopoly. There was opposition by that point from AT&T and from commercial interests that the post office would get involved. And, you know, had Reagan not been elected, had we had a different government in power in the early 1980s, it might have been, we would have gone in that direction. And that could have theoretically given us a very different history of the internet, but that's all, you know, here or there at this point. But that, it was certainly by no means clear in 1982 what we would have today would be the order of the day. Right. No one conceived of that.
So the progression of the internet has led to, obviously, social media websites, which are incredibly powerful and useful to a degree. They rely a lot on algorithms, which we've seen a lot of these algorithms spread misinformation and conspiracy theories like in mass, and they have real life consequences. I mean, we've seen things like QAnon, massive movement motivated by, I can't even get into that philosophy. And then there's Brexit, there's Cambridge Analytica. How do we deal with these sort of networks of misinformation? And I know we floated around, I think the government's floating around changes to Section 230. Should we be making any changes to this in order to combat misinformation?
I think this discussion begins by assuming that there are going to be a couple of global monopolies, specifically Facebook and Google, but a few others that own the world, and we can't mess with them, God forbid. They basically, they're God's gift to the human race, is these monopolies that with founders worth $200 billion. And if you start from that premise, well, it really limits what you can do. And I don't think you can solve the problem. But before we even talk about those internet monopolies and the vast fortunes they've created and the empires that are there and the power they wield, we should understand that, which is spoken about less frequently, but every bit as important, as the internet has emerged and created this space for QAnon and sophisticated conspiracies or unsophisticated ones, and sort of pummeling people with bogus information. While all this is taking place, something else is taking place concurrently that makes it possible that gets a lot less attention. Journalism has been eliminated. We no longer have journalism. And this is something people under the age of 35 or 40 probably don't even know what journalism is. I mean, what they think is journalism isn't it. There used to be a time, not too long ago in the United States, say certainly 30 years ago, and absolutely any time before 1980, when every community in the country had newsrooms of people who covered their community and actually got paid a living wage to do it. They were oftentimes unionized. So if you were in a city of 50,000, it had a daily newspaper, a major one. It had, you know, and if you were in a city of 1 million people, so you had, you know, large newsrooms, a newspaper and TV stations too, weekly publications. So there was information available about what was going on in your community, what was happening politically. And that system was not perfect. In fact, I made my living prior to the internet writing about the flaws in the journalism from that era. But it had resources. It had a lot of resources and a lot of working reporters. All of that is gone now. I don't know where you live, but I suspect there's not hardly anyone covering your community. You want to know anything about it, there's just not there. That's how it is everywhere. All those jobs are gone. So there's no journalism anymore. So when something comes along that seems ludicrous, QAnon is a good example. Well, in the olden days, if there was some whacked out conspiracy that doesn't hold up to the slightest investigation, a local reporter might have talked to the people. They wrote an article and it would have shown how it was complete BS. And people in the community said, yeah, that sounds like a lot of junk. But now there isn't that. So all you're left with is people get QAnon, and that's all they're exposed to. So the first way, and the democratic way to deal with misinformation, conspiracy theories, intentional lying like Cambridge Analytica and distortion to warp people's understanding of what's actually happening. The way around that is to get us journalism back. The first way to do that, if we had journalism, the problem would still exist, but it would be much smaller and much more easy to address. And it wouldn't require any censorship. It wouldn't require anyone locking up someone for their opinions. It would just mean you'd have actual journalism. And so I think the first order of business for anyone concerned about this is to put pressure on politicians to come up with a system to fund journalism at a sufficient level that we have a competitive, independent, uncensored, free press, which we don't have now. We just don't have a press system. Now, though, the way to, I should explain why journalism collapsed, because a lot of it is due to the internet, not exclusively. Part of it's due to the huge monopolies that sort of ran journalism to the ground by the 1990s and early 2000s. But when the internet came along, it basically killed the commercial, the model to make money of commercial journalism, which the money in journalism, newspapers, magazines, radio, television, came from advertising. That was where a majority of the income came from. And when advertising went to the internet and disappeared, then those companies couldn't keep reporters on anymore. They started to shrink. They started to shrink, and their readers started to say, well, there's nothing here. Why should I read this? Pay you to read your paper, and became a death spiral, which we're at the very end of now. So there's hardly any paid reporters left. Only in it, you know, there's some, but it's, you know, in terms of resources, daily newspapers, which are basically the main source of news still today, their online public versions are where the original reporting's done in most communities, are making approximately 1% they're making the total revenues that go to those industries is less than 0.1% of our GDP. 50 years ago, it was 1%. I mean, it's gone down by 90 some odd percent. There's hardly any resources at all compared to the whole balance of American history. And until we address that, we're never going to be able to do much about QAnon, because basically QAnon's running unopposed. Cambridge Analytica's running unopposed. Unless there's just another self-interested party that wants to battle with Cambridge Analytica, like King Kong versus Godzilla, but then who do you believe? That's the point of journalism, is so you have something you can believe.
Right.
And it backs up, it has evidence, and there's competing news media, and they're all trying to get at the truth to some extent. And once you lose that, it opens the door for charlatans of all stripes. And that's the world we live in today. So I'd say journalism's the key to solving that problem.
It's an interesting dichotomy, the rise of the internet and the decline of journalism. I also kind of feel like the hypercapitalism of the internet is kind of leading to this unhealthy addiction to the internet and social media, which is also becoming like breeding grounds for extremism. Do you think that big tech companies exploit this kind of unwellness that people have, that this attachment that they have to the internet that leads them to these wild rabbit holes?
Of course they do. I mean, their whole point, how do they make money? They make money by people consuming, going to Facebook or Google, clicking on stuff, loading up their computers with information about you so they can sell you stuff. If you aren't on the computer, if you're not coursing around with their services, they're not collecting info, can't make profits off you. So of course they want you to be addicted to it. They'd love to have, you know, you online 24/7 if they possibly could. The more you're there, the more you click around, the more you give them information, the better. That a problem? Well, yeah, I think it probably is a problem. Probably not a healthy thing. But certainly they have no incentive to reduce that. Their business model is built on developing that.
Yeah. I feel like local journalism would kind of improve that too. I feel like there would be less reliance on getting your news from the internet, therefore less time on the internet.
If we had funds to create local journalism, the vast majority of it would be consumed online. The days of print and ink are over.
Yeah,
I mean, they're never coming back. It's like the days of horse and buggies aren't coming back. It's an antiquated technology for the most part. There'll be some of it left, but not very much.
Right.
So it will be online. It's just that the quality should be superior. Mm-hmm. One of the problems with local journalism online too is that once you go online, distance is no longer a relevant cost factor. It doesn't really influence. So that's why there's not much local stuff. Because if you're online, you're basically anyone can access you anywhere in the world, unless a government stops it, but certainly anywhere in the country and most places in the world, which means, you know, the cost is so low that that's why you get these monopolies. They dominate the entire world in their market, not just one community. And that's a huge change. And that's one of the things that undermines the ability to start local media. Because if you do a local, where do you live?
I live in Marine Park in Brooklyn, New York.
Okay, you live in Brooklyn. If someone starts a really cool online news site in your neighborhood in Brooklyn, well, basically someone in Moscow, Russia could read it just as well as anyone in your neighborhood. Yeah. I mean, that's what, so the whole idea of localism is undermined by digital technology, which again, underscores how important it is to have clear policies to encourage localism.
One point that you constantly talk about too is the accessibility of internet. Specifically, high-speed internet is not really widely available among Black and Brown communities, and internet companies don't really want to create infrastructure in the rural areas. How can we ensure the internet remains a public tool that's accessible to all, and how do we get there?
Well, one thing we can do is get rid of these ISP companies like Comcast and AT&T, and get rid of these cell phone companies like AT&T and Verizon. Those are companies that do nothing of value. They contribute nothing to the human race. They're basically parasites. And what they are really good at is buying off government officials and regulators, so they get these monopoly licenses. So there's only a few companies left that you can get your cell phone service from. So we pay a fortune to these companies. They don't deserve that money. You pay much more than someone does in Germany or France for the exact same service, probably a worse service. And it's only because they have a monopoly and they own the politicians. So the first place we start is take the profit out of of the network. It shouldn't be. The government, we started it. They got these monopoly cable licenses and phone licenses, they've transferred them to the control over the internet. That's got to go. These guys have no function whatsoever, the ISP community, the cell phone community. And then we, when we do that, we can take a lot of the surveillance out too, because a lot of the way they get their income is by surveilling us and selling information, using it as they want. And if we did that, we just say, look, broadband access is a human right. Everyone gets it for free. You know, we're going to set up these networks and anyone can use them. Right. That's just entirely rational way to do it. Yeah. The only thing preventing that is these companies have, I mean, they have the Hall of Fame of lobbyists. AT&T, Verizon, you talk about lobbying power. I mean, that's what they do. Their whole business model is built on owning the government and having controlling politicians. It's not built on innovation. They don't innovate anything. We have this old clunky network compared to most countries because they get dragged kicking and screaming in innovation. They try to get the government to foot the bill whenever they can. So dealing with this ISP monopoly and ideally ending it and just having, you know, we'll pay them for their costs. I don't want to just expropriate their property. If they actually invested in some line, compensate them for what they spent. And they say, see you later, guys. Go find some other place to make a buck. We don't need you. And set it up so it's like the post office. It's just like an accessible system. Everyone gets it. You don't have to, just by being here, you get it, period. No questions asked. And I think that's a rational system. Then we wouldn't be having such an inane conversation over this issue.
Right. I also wanted to ask you how you felt about Trump's banning from all the social media platforms following the January 6th insurrection, or whatever you'd want to call it, on Capitol Hill. I mean, you know, people were kind of celebrating his removal from social media platforms, and I kind of get it. But we also saw a lot of prominent, maybe not so gigantic left platforms or left voices, but still prominent left-wing narratives and platforms that were being taken down. I think Hood Communist, which was like it's like a Black communist publication, their Twitter has been taken down with no explanation. So with that said, like, what does that say that these tech companies can just remove a sitting president or a president, period, from their platforms?
oh, a human being, period. I mean, I think, you know, it's, I think it's not a good thing at all. I think it's very bad. And I think I understand that when you have a fascist insurrection trying to take overturn an election, people aren't real happy that someone's lying about it and getting massive publicity. I certainly wasn't. But again, the answer to that is journalism that does its job. Censorship, I just don't think censorship in this case was a smart play because, like you just pointed out, it's not like Twitter's our best buddy. Who do you trust to censor? You don't, shouldn't trust anyone. That's why we oppose censorship. The solution is, of course, to have real journalism or resources for journalism to counteract the lies that someone like Trump propagates. But yeah, the idea that we want to start censoring Twitter or any of these people, that just, or allowing them to censor and applaud them for doing it too, all of that reeks, smells bad. I mean, it smells basically, we don't trust Twitter. They're out to make money. They might censor Trump because they saw he lost the election and they understand they want to be on the good side of the Democrats because the Democrats are about to come into power. So what happens if Trump actually won the election and started doing this stuff? They have to keep him up then? Well, then what's the difference between us and a dictatorship? Nothing. That's what an authoritarian state does. So yeah, this whole thing about having these Twitter or Facebook censoring people, I think it should make anyone alarmed. It's a principle we should oppose. It's a principle, period, discussion. Now, at the same time, that does lead to a more important question. Why the hell does one company have so much power over speech, i.e. Twitter? That's the real issue here. What do we do about the Twitters, the Facebooks, the Googles of the world, the Amazons, who have these massive monopolistic empires that are the most valuable companies in the world today? What do we do about the power they hold? Is that legitimate? And I think that is, along with getting rid of the ISPs and journalism, is the third great communication issue of our times, which is how do we address these internet monopolies? And I do think the one thing is pretty clear. Having these monopolies is inimical to having a democratic society. Great concentrations of wealth lead invariably, always, to massive growths of inequality of income and wealth, to increased poverty, to corruption in governments becomes much greater because the wealthy can buy off politicians who are much more likely to pay attention to them. So what we have to come up with a way to break up these giants, to deal with them, to remove their power, or we might as well throw in the towel on democracy. I just don't see how the two can coexist. And I think that's a discussion we're going to have in this country. Now, I don't think any of the politicians will be leading us to that discussion, or most of them won't, because they're getting their checks signed by these monopolies for the most part. They're very happy with them. And these monopolies are smart enough, like in the case of Twitter, to throw some bones at the Democrats and they have power. And then if the Republicans come back in, they'll probably throw some bones that way. But at the same time, it's inappropriate. I think, you know, when you have a monopoly, you know, these companies are so rich, not because they're such geniuses. When you have a monopoly, you make what economists call monopoly rents. Because you're the only provider or the only real provider, you control such a large amount of the market that you really are the only major provider. You make huge amounts of money simply because no one else is doing it. And that's what's called a rent. You don't really deserve it. Even by free market economics, it's not deserved income. It's just due to your monopoly. And we just have, if you're going to have an institution that has to be a monopoly, it's what's called a natural monopoly. It just functions best, like the post office. Well, then it should be publicly owned. It should be nonprofit. It should be transparent how it's run. It shouldn't be a profit center for Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates or anyone else. So they shouldn't be worth $200 billion because they have a monopoly. They haven't done anything to earn that money. Nothing. Bill Gates' net worth went up like $50 billion in the last year. He has nothing to do with that company for the last year. $50 billion. This is absurd. Yeah. This is absurd. So we've got that issue is one that's got to come up. We've got to deal with it. And again, we take care of journalism. We take care of the ISP monopoly. We take care of these internet monopolies. Those are the three areas we have to work on. And we do that. And we're a long way on the path towards having a far better society and dealing with the great communication issues of our times.
Right. I noticed that in the last chapter of your book, in Digital Disconnect, there was I'd say there was a pretty decent amount of mentions of Marx and Marxism to demonstrate like why capitalism allows for this kind of gross accumulation of wealth and why it doesn't allow for a society to provide for its citizens. How do you use Marxism to like analyze and come up with solutions for these problems with big tech? Because I also noticed that it's not entirely communism, your solutions. Like, you do not want to expropriate businesses and stuff like that, but you do want them to be publicly owned, which I think is appealing to people, because I don't think that people necessarily want communism. I think people fear over centralization, but I do think that it's interesting to explore alternatives that are not capitalism but are not communism. So could you speak about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, clearly at this point, in many ways, it's going to be the great issue of our lives. It's unavoidable. It hasn't always been that way. I'm 68 years old, and when I was coming of age, there was sort of an active left, a new left, they called it, but it was still very clear that was on the margins of society, at least it was to me, that it was the great bulk of the American population was not really tuned into what I was dealing with and what my peers were dealing with in the early 1970s. And at the same, so when I went to college, I was very interested in learning about how capitalism worked, very interested in learning just conventional economics, and also studying critical theory and Marxism. And so I had the privilege at the college I went to of basically reading Marx's work. You only studied one thing at a time. So the group of people, we read pretty much all of Marx's major works chronologically over the course of like 10 weeks. And this is after we'd done some history and some other stuff to set us up for it. So it gave me an opportunity to sort of really get a sense of who Marx was, what he was writing about, what the issues were. And so it had a great influence on me, because I think anyone in that class had a great influence. But I wouldn't say that you would read my work and call me a Marxist, because it influenced me. It influenced me not in like, this is how you programmatically solve the problems. I don't think you would read what I read in Marx and say, oh, this leads to the Soviet Union. There's no connection there at all. That's entirely a different phenomenon that comes for very different reasons much later, 70 years or so after Marx's, or 50 years after he's pretty much done his lion's share of his work. But it does have a methodological value, and it also very useful for trying to sort out what's going on. And so if you read my books, and I've written a lot in the last 30 years, I have a ton of books, and I think the references to Marx, they're probably, I doubt there's more than 5 or 10 in the 20 books I've written, if that. I mean, it's not like I'm invoking Marx here and there, quite the opposite. But I would say that tradition has influenced me. Many of the people who would consider themselves Marxists, economists especially, what they've written has had a lot of influence. I mean, not just them, though. Keynesians have, too, in terms of economists. They've been very influential on my development. But I think that it's Marxism sort of laid out one thing that's really crucial, which is it said that built within inside of capitalism is a fundamental problem, that on one hand, the nature of capitalism is that it makes a much more social world. It brings people together. The pursuit of profit basically draws the entire world into one unit eventually over time. That's its logic. We become much more social creatures that way, in the sense that we're linked. But at the same time, the nature of capitalism is that the benefits and profits accrue to a small number of people, increasingly at a global level. And that's a tension within capitalism that eventually will burst and has to lead to a post-capitalist society. And I would say on that fundamental point, what I think is called the supreme contradiction of capitalism is being proven true before our eyes today. I mean, that capitalism can't solve that problem, and it never will. But at the same time, what's a post-capitalist economy? I think the only way to solve a problem like this, and what you learn from the Soviet Union, among other things, is the solution is democracy. The solution is to make our democratic institutions so strong, meaning journalism, meaning the right to vote, meaning political parties, that participation is easy and encouraged, And then the fundamental, the first issue you have to settle in a democracy is what sort of economy you're going to have. And you know, it's something you debate, you experiment with. I think that there may be a place for profit making for a long time. I was a small businessman for years. I understand it. There may be, but I mean, that's a political decision. I do think it's pretty clear to me now, there's not a place for the sort of the Amazons, Googles, Twitters of the world. They are criminal enterprises. They have these huge monopolies. They're making a fortune, and they can buy off the politicians to keep their fortune. As long as they run the world, you know, we're in trouble.
Yeah. I like the idea of completely nationalizing the political process, because that's not what we oftentimes when we talk about politics and like democracy, we don't really discuss how the political process is kind of alienating, and how that tool in itself, it's not really this all-inclusive process like it's supposed to be. But if it were, things probably wouldn't be the way they are now. We probably wouldn't need communism.
Well, there's a great book out by a woman named Nancy McLean that came out like 5 years ago now, called Democracy in Chains. And the book basically chronicles something we're living right now, which is how at some point in the last 50 years, the right wing, the sort of Republican Party now has taken it over, determined they couldn't, but their policies were unpopular, that they couldn't win elections with their policies. And so among other things, they had to pack the courts with people who would interpret the Constitution like they want it, because they couldn't get those policies passed by Congress. And they had to also sharply reduce the ability of people to vote. That was crucial. That's what we're living through now in Georgia, that their numerator was never going to be very big. So they had to shrink the denominator to win elections. And this is something they've understood for decades. And they've been working at it for decades. And now it's sort of really becoming fundamentally clear. And one of the ways the right wing has found to win elections is it had to come up with a reason for people to vote for them. How do you get people to vote for slashing taxes on rich people, getting rid of education and Social Security? That's a tough sell for most people who, you know, aren't rich. They're saying, well, I don't know if that's such a good idea. Well, one of the crucial mechanisms that has been used and is being used now is, you know, play on nationalism and racism. I mean, that is like, it goes back a long history. But you know, that was Trump's strength. I mean, the people who voted for Trump were into the traditional like slash taxes sort of stuff, but they were definitely too fired up by that racist or anti-immigrant message. And that's sort of the world we're in now, that, you know, the democracy is getting, is such a problem for the system, that the interests and demands of people when they're fully activated really make it hard to maintain the status quo. That's why the battle for democracy isn't just about elections and the right to vote and civic issues. It's really about what sort of economy we're going to have. Because if we had, I think it's safe to say, if we had easy voting, same day registration, universal voter registration, and sort of the tradition, the things that we're looking for, we would have, in short order, a far more progressive country. The people in this country are much more progressive than you'd ever know, based on elections, the people in Congress. All these rules have been put in place to minimize popular control, and we need to do the exact opposite. We have to maximize popular control. And most people feel like political activity actually pays off. Gee, I got better schools. I've got breathable air. This is sort of cool. Once people see that connection, then the sky's the limit.
Right. One thing that you said on the, it was, I believe, for Democracy Now, that I've been thinking about since I've heard it. You mentioned that the current internet crisis, this is also something that I believe you've touched on in your book, is crisis. But the current internet crisis works in tandem with climate change, and nobody is going to be able to be apolitical at this point. Can you explain the relationship between the internet crisis and climate change?
Well, I can't remember that interview especially well, or what exactly the point I was making. But I will say that when we talk about the sort of generational existential issues facing the world right now, it is manifests most immediately in the climate. I mean, clearly, there are two or three great threats to human survival. The environment is one, nuclear war is the other, and both are closely connected to capitalism. Capitalism drives this brain dead expansion without any concern for the consequences. Let someone else deal with it down the road. As long as I'm making money now, that's all that counts. And that goes back to the point I made about the strength of Marxism. Marxism points out that the short-term obsession of capitalism makes it incapable of dealing with long-term social problems. And so, you know, to the extent democracy is truncated, dealing with the environment's that much becomes more impossible. The process of dealing with climate change is directly tied to the process of making societies more democratic, making those institutions work. And that means you're going to be changing the way your economy works. And that I think anyone who studies the environment, to my knowledge, understands we have to fundamentally change the way our economy works. It's not simply about recycling. We have to actually begin to rethink our relationship with the material world if we're serious about surviving the climate crisis. And so, by definition, if you talk like that, it's a democratic socialist undertaking at the very least, but it's a democratic undertaking. And if someone can make a compelling argument and have evidence that, hey, we can let these companies do their thing and they'll solve the climate crisis, let's have that debate. Let's see the evidence. But let's have all the evidence and have every position out there and get involved. I suspect we would head in a very different direction once we start taking it seriously. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's certainly, I think no interview on the state of politics today should avoid dealing with climate change during that interview. Because if you don't deal with that, you're just missing the boat.
Well, I am glad that I mentioned climate change.
Yeah. I'm glad you did too.
Robert, I really want to thank you for the time that you spent with us today. I really appreciate the conversation and the insight.
Hey, the pleasure's mine. Good luck with everything and keep up your work.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day.
All right, bye-bye.
Take care.
If you're enjoying Rift, please consider contributing to our Patreon. Rift is entirely volunteer-run, and donations help us continue to create new content focusing on progressive politics and culture.